Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. My name's Claire O'Connor. The Week at Work is a member of Left Block, that's leftblock.ie and Left Block with a C. Left Block is a political education and media platform, and if you go on there you can find some of our other podcasts, and we'll have articles on the website as well. If you're looking to support us, you can support us on patreon.com/leftblock, and again that's Left Block with a C. So this week I'm joined by Dr. Sean Byers of Trademark Belfast, and to be honest, the vast majority of stories we're going to talk about this week are going to relate to Palestine and what's happening with the bombardment of Gaza and the genocidal war crimes that are being inflicted on the people of Gaza at the minute by the apartheid Israeli state. We had, you know, I suppose a lot of the people that listen to this were probably at some of the protests that happened around the country yesterday. I was at the Dublin protest. We reckon, you know, we had maybe at least 20,000 people come out, which is, it's grown week on week, you know. You never know with these things whether people will turn out to a protest and maybe switch off and not keep coming, but it's amazing to see the consistency and the power of people's kind of emotional commitment to this, that they are coming out week on week and they are grown. And there was multiple protests in Dublin yesterday, and it was some really powerful speakers yesterday, particularly some really powerful Palestinian women, Gazan women who spoke yesterday. Their families are still in Gaza. They speak and knowing that their families could be persecuted even more by them speaking out on an international stage like that. So just absolute solidarity to everybody in Gaza and all the Palestinian people around the world, you know, who are having to worry about what's happening to their families right now. Sean, you've been to some of the protests up north. How have they been?
Yeah, so the first protest last Saturday attracted a crowd of about 10,000 people, we're saying, which is massive for the size of Belfast. And a lot of people were saying that it would surpass the biggest protest in support of Palestine that's been held in the last 20 years. So it is the biggest one. There are a number of vigils and more localized protests that were held during the week, including one, a large one that was held at the Northern Ireland office in the city center. There's a vigil at the International Wall. And then yesterday, I was at the protest, the demonstration, which marched from City Hall to the BBC in Belfast. And again, we're talking about thousands at that. And that's even taking into account the large number of people who I know were in Dublin for the national protest. So we still had thousands at the Belfast one. And again, as you said, like there's Palestinian community come out in large numbers. There were a couple of great Palestinian speakers. There was a large crowd of Palestinians in attendance. So that was really good to see.
Yeah, and sometimes I hear from people, because obviously we kind of attend protests all the time or organise them, and people talk about like, but you know, is it actually having an impact? And I've been in contact with people in Gaza. We have a Dub for Gaza group down here, Dublin for Gaza, and we occupied the EU Commission office in town on Thursday, and because we wanted to speak to the representative here of the EU Commission, and it was about, you know, the European stance and the fact that they won't even ask for a ceasefire. And we had it. You can go onto the Dublin for Gaza socials and see the kind of, you know, the demands that we were putting forward. But I was in contact with one particular woman in Gaza that I know as we were there, and I was sending her pictures of it, and her communicating how much that meant to her, those small actions, things that are very easy for us to do. The Western world is standing against them. The vast majority of the Western world are encouraging these war crimes that are being committed on them. It's incredible. First of all, there's the impact it's having on the people of Gaza, just to know that a huge millions of people around the world stand with you. But also, there's a massive disconnect between world leaders and the people. So you look particularly in Britain, I think. I mean, they reckon yesterday in London, I read that they reckon a couple of hundred thousand people came out, and that was one of the top 10 protests in the history, you know, of protesting in Britain. And I mean, can you have a stronger message? I know we know these kind of protests change things. We know the water movement had a direct impact. Politicians at the end of the day are all about votes. If they think that it's going to affect their voting base and getting re-elected, there's a chance that it will actually impact them, and it'll actually get them motivated. So I just think there is a real impact on what's happening there. On the occupation on Thursday, two of our members got to go up and meet the representative of the Commission in Ireland, and said, no, that's not our position. So we asked for the call for a ceasefire. You think that's such a basic ask in what is supposed to be set up as a peace project, which is laughable hearing people talk about the EU imperialist institution like that now. But she just said no. She said that's not our position. And I mean, when you break it down to that, you know, something that simple, that you are not willing to actually ask for peace. Like that's where we're at now. And I think that Yeah, we can have absolutely no trust in those kind of institutions with what's on the line right now.
Yeah, but as you said, like the people in power are totally out of step with international public opinion. I mean, the protests involving millions of people, as you said, towns and cities across the globe, has involved defiance of government bans on protests in the likes of France and Germany, but also in the likes of Egypt, where large public protests have been outlawed by the Sisi government since coming to power in 2013. You know, we've seen large numbers from the Jewish community condemning what the Israeli government is claiming to be doing in their name, including in New York and Washington, D.C. You've seen the occupation of Capitol Hill. And in those parts of the world and in Europe, protests and direct actions are having an impact, both in terms of exposing the complicity of governments in the ongoing genocide, and forcing them to shift their position, not to the extent that we would like, or not to the extent that the Palestinians need, but you can see cracks in the armor starting to appear and the pressure starting to tell. So you can see it even at an EU level. You know, the EU Commission, the European Commission, and the wider EU bureaucracy, I think, underestimated the strength of support and sympathy for Palestine within its member states. So, like, there's 9 or 10 member states, I think, that recognize the State of Israel, and there's several others, notably France, that have been forced to arrive at a more critical position regarding the Israeli government. The European Commission has had to backtrack on its initial plan to withdraw aid from Palestine. European Council is now talking about the need for de-escalation. That uncritical support that was expressed for Israel by von der Leyen is gradually coming undone. So we are seeing the impacts of those protests in Europe and beyond.
And I think as well, what's really interesting is you are talking there about, like, so it's illegal to carry a Palestinian flag in some places in the world now because of this. And what we haven't seen, because we know that at the root of this is white supremacy. It's absolute white supremacy and Islamophobia. That's why the fog of war as well around the world is able to people are able to pretend that they don't see what this really is, because it actually reinforces the kind of Islamophobia that has been bred for decades. But I think we haven't seen the far right who talk about free speech and the right to protest and, that this is what they say their platform has been for so long. We're not seeing them coming out and supporting people protesting for Palestine, in the face of the crackdowns and protests and the crackdown on people being able to show solidarity. So I think times like this really show those people for who they are as well. The hypocrisy that's rooted in, because we have the likes of David Quinn in. He has columns all over the place, but he's with the Iona Institute. He's all about free speech. He's all about free speech for the far right. He's all about free speech, when it's hateful and when it's, but now he's all about balance. And now he's all about, supporting the Israeli people and us being biased here. And he has nothing to say about the crackdown on free speech around the world. And it's just, it really shows these people, I think, for who they are. I think what's really, like, another massive story this week as well is Paddy Cosgrave, who is a controversial figure. And I think the fact that a lot of people really don't like, Paddy Cosgrave is the CEO of Web Summit. A lot of people just don't like Paddy. He can be his own worst enemy. And because of that, the reaction, I think, is very different to what it would be from if it was anybody else. So Paddy came out and made a statement, and he basically said, we should name war crimes even when they're perpetuated by our allies. I'm paraphrasing there, but that's what he said. He it was, as I think, very mild and absolutely not controversial. He also said at the end of it, I will not relent. Within a day or two, he had apologized, an official apology up on the website. And yesterday he resigned as so, and he resigned because of the amount of people that withdrew. And I'm just actually like, I'm going to get a list of some of them now, because so it started off with the likes of, Siemens and HP and, or sorry, Intel. Then it was Gillian Anderson, the actress. And now people have just been removed from the website. So like Amy Poehler was supposed to speak, LL Cool J, like some pretty, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. They tend to have these big stars, and then they have all the big IT companies. Now Google have pulled out, Amazon have pulled out, and I just am outraged by the articles and the response to it, that they're not talking about the powerfulness of this lobby, that the capital and the power behind this are silencing people. They're silencing somebody who just said Can we treat everybody the same? Can we call out war crimes regardless of who does it? It was the most like uncontroversial statement. And privately, a lot of people are saying that. But because Paddy is such a controversial person, and a lot of people just, are very vocal, particularly online, in their dislike for him, they're not saying that. They're kind of they're rubbing their hands with glee at the fact that this has happened. And it's just so dangerous. It's like, rather than us talking about these massive companies that seem to have a problem with just saying, can we call out war crimes when they happen? I think it's a real failure in the media. It's a real failure in the media not to critically analyze what's actually happening here and how dangerous it is and the kind of precedent that it sets. And it's been infuriating reading the articles and what people have been saying online.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I think that's, the focus on the personality and the individual has been reflected in a lot of the articles been written about the incident. What he said was quite modest and only really reflects the views of many human rights organizations and UN experts. They're not the views of revolutionaries that we're talking about here. So what he said was in line with what those organizations and experts are saying. But I think the whole incident, as you said, demonstrates the power of big tech companies, and their worrying role and growing role as geopolitical actors. And what the articles written about this incident won't draw your attention to is the fact that several of these big IT firms that withdrew, Intel, Google, HP, and others, have relationships with the State of Israel. And they profit from Israeli apartheid in different ways, whether it's through investment deals or contracts or whatever it might be. So their response wasn't all that surprising. So I have a certain level of sympathy for Paddy on this, right? What I'd also say though, right? On the other hand, I'm going to do an on the other hand. On the other hand, what I think the incident highlights also is the importance of just holding the fucking line when it comes to the basic principles of solidarity and justice and telling the truth about what's happening before our eyes. So he's a person with a profile. I think ultimately he should have stood his ground. There are people in much more precarious positions taking strong principled stands in solidarity with Palestinians at the risk of losing their lives and their livelihoods, at the risk of losing their jobs even. So Paddy Cosgrave was never going to starve in doing likewise,
Exactly. Yeah. It's an ex it so a part of the article that's written about it talks about, and it's Niamh Horan as well. Niamh Horan and Adrian Rechler wrote it in the Sunday Independent, and it talks about the speech he gave to the staff as well. So he has 200 staff in Ireland, 300 around the world, like it's total around the world. And he talks about how he's apologizing them. I know he puts us in really difficult positions. He's getting a lot of abuse, all this kind of thing. And it goes into detail about how last year, so they were nearly bankrupt during COVID, and last year they had a lot of people boycott the event because they thought it was very pro-Russia in the context of the Russia-Ukraine war, and that a lot of the journalists that were invited very, very pro-Russia. And that was a kind of smaller version of what we're seeing this year. And it's trying to influence, it's these massive companies trying to influence geopolitics through an event that has absolutely nothing got to do with it. This is an IT event. Do you know what I mean? Like, but this is what these companies do. And it does highlight how involved in geopolitics and how much they exploit and financially benefit from the likes of an apartheid system. And I think that's where I'd like to see journalists going and actually writing about. I'd like to see that, because we all have social media, we all have the internet access to articles. We can see the reporting, we can see what's happening. We need journalists to be going behind the scenes and talking about, why this is happening and what impact this power is actually having on the world. Because we've already seen apartheid in South Africa and how BDS and how the world was actually able to influence, killing that off. And the fact that it's as if that never happened, and the fact that we can look at this and the level of propaganda, but also and we've seen examples, it's been for years it's been written about how Israeli basically, they will do something, they will deny they did it, they'll say that Palestinians did it. And by the time people realize that Israel has done it, or they admit themselves they've done it, the rage has lessened and we were onto something else, and it's so effective. And we saw that with the bombing of the hospital as well, because people were afraid, even in governments around the world, they were couching their language. They were being careful not to say definitively that this happened in case it turned out that it didn't. It just sows doubt in the back of people's minds and they allow it to. And yeah, I agree. I don't think Paddy would have been any worse off we would have been a hell of a lot better off in terms of his reputation and integrity if he had have stood firm and just said, what I said was in line with human rights organizations. If these companies have a problem with these human rights organizations, you know, they should come out and say it, because him resigning is not going to bring these companies back into the fold. You know, I mean, as this was happening yesterday, we had UN officials standing at the Rafah crossing trying to negotiate to let aid trucks in, as people are, they haven't had water in days. The last bakery was bombed yesterday in Gaza. Like this, so even their ability to cook food at this stage is being impacted. So while this kind of farce is going on as well, this is what's actually happening outside Gaza. You know, you have aid trucks at the border, not sure if they when they get in, if they're going to be bombed by Israeli warplanes. So it's like when you just hold, you know, you hold these two things together, it's outrageous.
No, I just to reiterate, it's just really important that those anybody who is interested in justice and a lasting settlement for the Palestinian people just hold the line in the face of all these attempts by the media, by vested corporate interests, by the Israeli state to confuse matters, to divert our attention away from what is actually happening. As you said, it happened in the hospital. That's just a tried and tested tactic of the Israeli state to confuse and to disrupt and to divide the international solidarity movement for Palestine. Like, so it's just really important just to hold the line.
That's it. And like you said, you know, a lot of the Palestinian speakers specifically yesterday spoke about, like, I've been going to Palestinian marches since I was a teenager. I, you know, got to see the West Bank in 2009. So they can be very small at times. And then when something happens, like 2014, 2018, the numbers grow and the protests grow. And now we have all, you know, one of the women yesterday said, like, if the bombardment stops, please hold the line. Please do not go back to forgetting about us, because until the occupation is ended, until the Palestinian people have freedom and peace and self-determination, this is not over. So just because this immediate crisis may be, you know, resolved, if that word can even be used, over the next couple of weeks, you know, there's a real fear that it would just go back to, you know, what they've been living in or living under for 75 years, and particularly for the last 17 in Gaza. What do you think of, I mean, as much as our government has not gone nearly far enough in the south, it's, you know, we're trying to push them, but when you compare them to around the world, there's a sense of relief, I think, for a lot of people that they're not doing what the likes of, you know, the British parties are doing or the international parties are doing. What do you think of the, particularly the British Labour Party response?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. If you know anything about the history of the British Labour Party, you'll know that it's been largely pro-imperialist for in its politics for its entire existence. And this is pretty much involved consistent su support for the Israeli state and the condemnation of Palestinian resistance for the last 75 years. So you have to look at Corbyn, both in terms of left-wing economics. And anti-imperialism as an aberration, like as an accident in the long history of the British Labour Party. And Keir Starmer sits more firmly within the pro imperialist and pro-Israeli tradition that has defined all of the party's other past leaders. But what I think he's done is totally underestimate the strength, like other leaders in other parts of Europe, totally underestimated the strength of public sympathy for Palestine, including among large sections of its membership, the Labour Party's membership and its potential support base. So I don't know if you've seen, like he basically gave an interview last week on LBC radio station where he defended Israel's
Oh,
decision.
yeah.
Yeah. He
Yeah.
defended Israel's decision to cut off water, electricity, and fuel to Gaza, which is collective punishment and a war crime by the standards of international law. And in response to this, he's been widely criticized within the party. There's been 25 resignations, 25 or so resignations of councillors. Several others have threatened to resign. There was a pro-Palestinian protest at the party's headquarters on Friday. The London Muslim Network has demanded an apology, warning that the party risks losing a huge amount of support in Muslim communities in Britain as a result. And this is against a wider backdrop of the Labour leadership being accused of failing to take seriously reports of Islamophobia, its decision to deselect 19 councillors in Leicester, the majority of which are from ethnic minority backgrounds, for the local elections in May. So all of this taken together with the protest on Saturday has put him under serious pressure. And he's obviously been advised to try to salvage this situation. So like defending war crimes and an attempt at genocide doesn't poll very well, or play out strongly in focus groups that he's organizing,
I've
but
seen some
instead
of the interviews, yeah, where he's trying to
of
pull it
just
back.
yeah, he's trying to pull it back, but instead of just fucking holding up his hands up and apologizing,
Yeah.
he's trying to squirm out of it, and he's trying to argue that he's been misrepresented.
Yeah. What I actually meant was,
Yeah,
yeah.
what I actually meant was, oh, I didn't realize what that's the question that was being asked. Despite he was asked to clarify his position during the interview. We're not talking about the right of Israel to defend itself. We're talking about the right of Israel to impose forms of collective punishment on the population of Gaza. And he says, I think Israel has the right to do that. So
Yeah.
there was no confusion, there was no ambiguity in terms of what he was being asked. But now he's trying to worm out of it, and he's just trying to say, oh no, I was misrepresented. Oh no, I didn't realize what I was being asked at the time. Bollocks. Absolute bollocks. He's just a proven, brazen, cynical liar.
That's not surprising. I mean, for a lot of people, I mean, he has such. Like he's just such an embarrassment to the Labour Party, even for like you said, the Labour Party has a long history of imperialism and also is a centrist party, like the it obviously has very strong leftists in it over the years, but we've seen what's been done to them, you know what I mean? So like we're none of this is really, really surprising, but like you said, I'm more surprised that he didn't realize he didn't have the political insight or his advisors didn't warn him actually the impact this would have on the ground. On the resignations within the party, the voting, even from a cynical perspective, it's like you'd nearly think he'd have more cop on than that he'd realize that this how badly that the pushback on this would be. And yeah, it's shocking. It's also the whole the pretty like much two-party system in Britain is like it highlights this because it's like where do people go? Where do leftists go, within politics in Britain? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly that something needs to be set up for people to stop holding on to the idea that the Labour Party is going to be that for the left.
Yeah, I think I think he was focused. I think it also exposes the limits of his intellect. Like he's ruthless, but he's obviously not very clever. And he relies on the stats and whatever else that are provided to him from focus groups. So they didn't focus group this one out. He was paying too much attention to
Big boys.
the strong Friends of Israel lobby within the Labour Party and within British politics. I think he was leaning too heavily into that, whilst at the same time underestimating the strength of sympathy for the Palestinian people within British society. But as you say, he wouldn't hold out. I think he'll come under more pressure. He'll continue to come under pressure until he changes his position on Gaza a bit more. And I think it will continue to shift, maybe not to the extent that we need to bring about a serious realignment. I wouldn't hold out much hope that the Labour Party will come to the salvation of the Palestinians. Like, I mean,
No.
I think it says something that only 34, at the last count, 34 Labour MPs support an immediate ceasefire. So I think that shows you the level of political cowardice, cynicism, and reaction that exists within the Parliamentary Labour Party. And the Labour Party left has been found wanting for a long period of time.
Yeah,
Like,
yeah. I think as well, like. I think he is a very epitome of what Emma Caron calls the cult of civility. I think he would be looking to the very quote big boys around the world. He's looking to America. He's looking to who he sees as the respectable leaders of the free world. Like this is the type of person he is. He's very much in that. He's a very conservative like man. I mean, the idea that he was a human rights lawyer is just. It's mind blown, and it just shows how, yeah, there's a whole other conversation. But I also think, what
he's
about
playing
the,
the part, yeah.
oh yeah, like 1,000,000%. What about the, he's a massive, wants to be a liberal, like, what about the trade union response? We saw Mick Lynch coming out and asking, the RMT to get on the streets and to rally. We saw Ictu, Patricia McKeown spoke at the rally in Dublin yesterday, but Ictu came out with a kind of strong enough statement there early last week. And a lot of the larger unions that I know SIPTU and a couple of them, of course, they were emailing their members asking them to get out on the streets and to get out and march and to, so the way they mobilize their members, that was happening quite quickly down here. What do you think of some of the more the British unions or even Unite, which covers, the whole of Ireland and Britain?
Yeah, well, as you say, there was an element of both sidesism to the Act Two statement, but that's to be expected. I think overall, it was good in highlighting Israeli war crimes, condemning the occupation, reiterating support for BDS.
Yeah,
That
I felt
was
like it went
good.
beyond the Irish government response.
Yeah, it
It
did.
did go that step further. It's not, listen, it's not as radical as any of us would want, as any of us would want. But yeah, I think when things are so bad, you kind of.
Yeah, I know that. No, I thought it was sound enough, and like, as you said, a decent number of affiliates have mobilized their members in solidarity. Like overall, I suppose we've seen a similar response in Britain. Like the TUC statement's not that bad. It's not as radical as the Ict Two statement. Doesn't go as far, but it's not too bad. And we've seen similar levels of trade union mobilization in Britain, spearheaded by, I would say, a smaller number of unions, the RMT, some of the teaching unions, NEU, a couple of others. I have to say, like, I'm a member of Unite, and I'm really disappointed with Unite's response. It was a whole week before Unite HQ said anything about what was happening in Gaza. And then when it did, it was to issue like a mealy-mouthed statement that didn't call for a ceasefire, didn't address the ongoing system of apartheid, or even express support for BDS, which is actually Unite policy, democratically determined by its membership. And this is at a time when the Palestinian unions are explicitly calling for the international trade union movement to show practical solidarity by taking action against the arming of the Israeli state and companies involved in it, as they did with apartheid South Africa. So, like, I'm a member of Unite because I've generally seen Unite as a fighting union. It's a union that's more inclined to take industrial action. It's a union that tends to find itself on the right side of history when political questions, domestic political questions, anyway. And it's a union that's placed more emphasis on organizing. So they're all good things, like, but it's narrow focus, certainly under the current leadership. It's narrow focus on winning improved pay and conditions for its members in the Imperial Corps, particularly Britain, that has come at the expense of genuine internationalism,
Yeah.
and that's even more so the case with Unite, given that a lot of its members are employed in factories that are supplying munitions and technology to the Israeli state. So I'm really disappointed with the response at a leadership level, but I have seen that Unite branches are starting to pass motions in response to the appeal made by Palestinian unions. There's an open letter that's out from rank and file members encouraging the Unite leadership to take a stronger and more proactive stance in line with its own policies. So we're starting to see some movement
Yeah.
from a bottom-up sort of perspective, but I'm really disappointed with the leadership's response.
Yeah, and like any of the when we set up like Communities Against Racism down here, and a lot of the anti-racist, anti-fascist work that we kind of pre-COVID had started really organizing, like branch type structures nationally was really supported by Unite. They really were putting the money and the time into those kind of anti-racist, anti-fascist organizing structures. So I was really disappointed with that as well. And I think a lot of people are, and I think particularly because most, a lot of trade unions have been quite good on this, it stands out even more. It's, it makes them, it kind of singles them out as being so poor on this, which is, and I think the point you made, which I don't think a lot of people know, would be the fact that Unite do represent a lot of, like you're talking, they're kind of embedded in the military industrial complex. Like it's what, how do you separate that? Or how do you represent workers without supporting war? Like it's a, I think it's a much broader question.
Yeah, and look, it's a question of leadership. I mean, I know that it's easy for me to point out these contradictions and these challenges. Like, it's much more difficult resolving them. You know, like the stock response whenever you raise something like this is, "Oh, what the fuck do you want? Do you want to see people lose their jobs?" So, but at the same time, as I said, it's a question of leadership. I mean, trade unions have to lead at times when it comes to question when it comes to climate action, when it comes to international solidarity, instances of oppression, when it comes to war, trade unions have to lead. International solidarity, internationalism is supposed to be at the heart of what they represent, and that involves having some very difficult conversations with their members, and it involves supporting members where they decide to take action,
Yeah.
when they decide to do something. And we've
Yeah.
seen nothing of the sort.
And it's like when you lose it, it's like it is difficult conversations. It's like when it there's not always a very easy answer, but if you're ignoring it and you're just acting like it's not happening, you are taking a side. It's like if you were, if you're not acting in the face of injustice, like you're taking a side. But I think all of these stories have a similar thread, and it is that there is such a powerful pressure. There is such lobbying going on, and that lobbying is backed by capital. It's backed by international power. It's backed by, people who have a disproportionate amount of power. The heads of states, the heads of these massive companies, and they are financially benefiting from this occupation. But it is the war industry. It there are so many people financially benefiting. I don't know if you saw the image of it was the stock prices of some of the biggest and arms companies in the world, and just after this happened, they absolutely skyrocketed. And at the at the end of the day, that's what's happening here. People are profiting from this, and they're profiting in the billions. There's another story I just want to touch on before we move off this conversation. There's two. One is the Irish Independent, and it's Niamh Horan again. It's an exclusive. Israeli ambassador claims Michael D. Higgins' Gaza remarks were inflammatory and says Ireland isn't neutral. I want to touch on the Ireland isn't neutral thing in a minute, but I in a private WhatsApp chat, I remember the minute Michael D. Higgins said this, I was like, wait and see all the people who had no issue with Ursula von der Leyen massively overstepping her position and going way outside the remit in it. Like, and she did this in a way that had a material impact on the lives of millions of Palestinians. She encouraged Israel to do what they did. And all the centrists and all the right wingers had absolutely no problem with that. The minute Michael D. Higgins stands up and says something that is bait again, it's in line with humanitarian organizations across the world. Like, it wasn't massively radical anything he said. It was a human plea for a ceasefire for, let's recognize war crimes. And we have all these people coming forward saying that he overstepped the mark. He is threatening the institution of the president, that he, just outrageous. I mean, if the institution of the president is threatened by somebody asking for genocide not to be inflicted on the Palestinian people, I think we need to look at the office of the president rather than, jumping at the man himself.
I haven't read the in the article, although like what they expect from the Israeli ambassador. I have read the article by Harry McGee in the Irish Times, which addresses the same subject, and he says that Michael D. Higgins overstepped the mark with his comments about von der Leyen and all that sort of stuff. The first thing I'd say is they're comparing apples with oranges. Like, the Irish president is elected by the people of Ireland to represent the people of Ireland and has discretion to make public statements about different issues, so long as they don't conflict with government policy, right? Von der Leyen is a glorified civil servant who isn't elected by European demos at all. She has no mandate for making up foreign policy, much less articulating it on behalf of EU member states. And not only that, but people in Ireland expect their president to embody the views and principles that they hold. You know, they expect the president to be political with a small p, and this is a custom that's been followed not only by Higgins on a range of issues, but which nobody had a problem with whenever he's speaking out in different issues, but by McAleese before him and by Robinson before her. They all made public pronouncements on political questions. It's what people vote for in Ireland, it's what they expect.
And has like when you hear when history writes about particularly Mary Robinson, because she kind of redefined, very purposely redefined the office of the president. She did things differently. That was, like when you read what's written about her, people talk about that in such a positive way. And it's like But that's what they're actually criticizing him now for, because they don't want him saying what he's saying. But again, it's apples and oranges. It's so obvious where the push is coming from, and you know where, who is being silenced and who the attempt to silence is. There's another article from Paul Cunningham. Paul Cunningham was over, I think he's in Tel Aviv now. But basically, the whole article is him talking about how he was at a rally or a vigil, I think it was, for the hostages, Israeli hostages that are still in Gaza, and that this Israeli man came over to him, an older man, asked him where he was from. He said Ireland, and the man said, "You don't stand with us," emphasizing the "with us." And he went through this whole article talking about how stunned Israeli people are when they come to Ireland, and they think that we are blinded by the Palestinian propaganda. We're blinded by our bias. We're like, it's really, you know, if anybody reads it, and it talks about how, you know, Israelis have an app on their phone where multiple times every day they get told to, you know, to go to bomb shelters because Hamas rockets are raining down on them and stuff like that. And but it has no you know, there's no analysis on like why why are we in this situation? What are the Palestinian people experiencing? The disproportionate level of surveillance, the disproportionate weight of the weapons, the, you know, it's completely pulling at the heartstrings and suggesting that we don't care about those people, those lives, or, and it just lack and such journalistic analysis.
Yeah, and I've noticed it like across the papers, you know, the papers that I was looking at, like just a total lack of analysis of the situation in Palestine, you know, the origins of the current situation, like how that has developed over the past 75 years, you know, it doesn't go below the surfaces of isn't awful what's happening, and you know. It's awful to see all those people dying on both sides, and that is the extent of the analysis that can be given.
And even when you say people dying, so the language that is used is great linguistics that have been highlighting this. So, Israeli people are murdered and Palestinian people die, you know, as if it's of natural causes. There's nobody kills them. Nobody made a decision to do this. Even in some of our own articles, like what I found really interesting, that Niamh Horan and Adrian Rechler piece about Paddy Cosgrave, the whole article, right, goes into the response, and it says, it talks about his comments about Israel, right? Never once actually says what he says. So if someone's coming to this for the first time, they're just going to assume, oh my God, he must have said something horrific about, you know, Israeli people, or, you know, must have been very insensitive, or, and they don't actually know, they don't get the opportunity to read it and say, oh, hold on a second, this is disproportionate, do you know? And like, like those things are just so important. And I thought that, and I'm not like, and I'm not saying journalists can't also interview Israeli people. We know a lot of Israelis were protesting that Netanyahu only a couple of weeks ago. Not all Israelis, like, you know, are pro-Israel in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, that can't extend to settlers. If you're living in a settler's colony, like, you are a settler colonizer. That's just an absolute fact. But I think as well, what's lost from the commentary is the fact that, seeing bits of it coming through now, the increase in violence in the West Bank. So some particularly Palestinian, or people from the Middle East particularly, are talking about this. You know, what does a world without Hamas look like? It looks like the West Bank, you know, who have had an unprecedented level of deaths and murders in the past couple of weeks. So,
I
yeah, I
saw
mean,
that. I think Varoufakis was one of the people that I thought saw making that point and making it very well. Like he says, look, let's perform a thought experiment where Hamas doesn't exist. What happens then? Does the violence disappear? Does the need to address the occupation disappear? He says, no, it doesn't, because the situation pertains in the West Bank. Hamas doesn't exist to any great extent. You have a Palestinian authority in the West Bank that has long agreed to a peaceful political settlement to the conflict and the question of Palestinian statehood. And yet, as you said, like they were under continued attacks. And the pressure of displacement by Israeli settlers with the backing of the IDF. And I read, I think there were more Palestinians attacked by settlers with the backing of the IDF last night.
yeah, it's daily. Like, you know, the videos doing the round are horrific. Like, and I think as well, what doesn't get talked about enough is the what's also emerging now is the, you know, a lot of the hostages that are being released are questioning the kind of narrative that came out at the start, and the narrative that all the Israelis that were killed by Hamas. So some of the pastors are coming out and saying that Israeli IDF soldiers basically just started shooting at indiscriminately at everybody, and that they actually murdered a lot of Israeli people too. And I think that, not suggesting for a second that, Hamas didn't. I mean, that was, the purpose of that was violent revolution. Like that, that was obviously at the root of what was happening. But it's another element of how the attempt to make Hamas, barbaric and inhuman and to dehumanize, and it is tied to Islamophobia as well. We always see this, and the IDF as these brave, courageous soldiers who only, fight because they have to, or own don't target civilians, and it's all part of it, and it's all part of the fog of war, and it's all part of the misinformation. And that when you dehumanize people, it makes what Israel are doing unjustified to some people. But I think hopefully that does start to come out more and more, and we start to see more truth. And again, all the hostages that I've seen released have talked about how humanely they were treated. And hopefully this starts to break down some of the misinformation that's being shared.
Yeah, I think that is starting to pull apart. The majority of people don't believe at this stage a word that comes out of the Israeli state's mouth, in relation to this. Whether it's hostages, whether it's the issue of humanitarian aid, whether it's, who's responsible for what, no one, very few people at this stage believe anything that's coming from the Israeli state, from Netanyahu or anyone else.
We saw CNBC, an American news station. A CNBC reporter came out after the hospital was bombed, and he spoke for about 10 minutes about how Israel have lied in the past. We cannot trust, what's coming out of Israel. We have to have it independently verified. To have a CNBC reporter say something like that is a big deal, on an American news station. Channel 4 had an excellent piece on, I mean, how farcical it was that the Israelis, first of all, they put up videos that were clearly false that night of the hospital. The timestamp was wrong. Like it was really poor in terms of just the quality of the propaganda. The next morning, they had put out a video of an audio they said were two Islamic jihadists, basically talking about wasn't it awful that this had misfired? Like it was ridiculous. Experts came in and broke it down and talk about how the two voices were recorded independently. They weren't even in the same place having the conversation. That the tone, the dialect, the accents, like it was all wrong. Like it was all wrong. And it's been broken down in very quick, with quick turnaround of in real time. But again, it's enough to put the doubt in people's minds, and enough people's minds that that's not been reported on. If the world had been able to report on that hospital immediately and they had wanted to, I think things might have been very different. But they're just so good at slowing things down and waiting, and something else happens, and then we're on for another conversation. Yeah, I think we could do. I'm sure we could do another hour on what's happening over in Gaza and Palestine, because it's so horrific, and it's so frustrating to watch the international media and the world kind of engage in the fog of war. But I suppose we will try and cover the last a couple of stories. Try and cover a couple of small stories quickly. One that again enraged me even more was there's an article from Grand Unier, on Francis Fitzgerald, the MEP, Fine Gael MEP, talking about the lack of urgency to tackle violence against women. So it's about a European bill, and it's a she's talking about how a lot of states, a lot of member states, and a lot of MEPs are willing to support around kind of female genital mutilation, around different aspects of violence against women, but when it comes to rape, they won't include anything around consent. All of it very valid. That everything she says, I completely agree with. Everything she says is really valid. What enrages me is, and it comes back to this idea of almost social progressiveness and liberalism, where this is from somebody who was a senior official in a party that oversaw massive poverty, particularly among women and particularly among lone parents, who are then disproportionately trapped in violent relationships and actually don't have the means to escape, don't have the means to be self-sufficient, like, and it increases women's risk of violence. So it's this thing again about seeing it a lot through the likes of Repeal, and that, oh yeah, we're willing to fight for a piece of legislation around violence against women. We're not willing to address the poverty that disproportionately puts women in these situations. So it's that lack of economic politics, or it's left-wing politics, but it for me, it comes back to that idea of kind of social progressiveness, and it just infuriates me because it's so easy to support these things materially, but if you're not going to address the root causes, then we're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and addresses these issues at a surface level, you know, and that's where Fine Gael are in particular are comfortable. You know, they're comfortable with you know, liberalization and individual rights and those types of policies that you talk about, but not addressing the root issues, the structural causes, root causes of the situations that people find themselves in, like, and that's where Fine Gael are at.
And what about I? What other stories jumped out to you this week? I had what's happening up at the Belfast Telegraph, and I think the same story really jumped out to both of us.
The Belfast Telegraph's pretty piss poor, like, but there was an article by Sam McBride I found interesting, and he's addressing the conundrum faced by the DUP under its leader Geoffrey Donaldson. So, as people know, the DUP's been boycotting Stormont for 18 months now in protest at the supposed threat that the protocol poses to the integrity of Northern Ireland's place in the Union. Like, first of all, I don't believe that the protocol was the DUP's main issue in the first place. What happened was that the DUP was losing support as a result of its own disastrous miscalculations over Brexit. It became the largest party because of this, and then it honed in on the protocol as an issue, as something that would allow them to mobilize their base and restore a certain level of support, recapture support from some of their rivals. But regardless, the protocol has become the issue, and Donaldson's leader position as leader has rested on his promise to get rid of the protocol before re-entering Stormont. He's coming under increasing pressure to re-enter Stormont due to the crisis of public services, cost of living, and so on. And he's softened his position a wee bit and come to accept that the strategy now is how to choreograph the restoration of Stormont in a way that allows him to say that he's got what he was after in terms of removal of the protocol and any threat of an RAC border. So someone has convinced Donaldson that this new Windsor framework provides a foundation for this, because at the recent D and I suspect it may have been the British government, because at the recent DUP conference, he was hinting at a return to Stormont on this basis. And I know that preparations are being made for a return sometime maybe in December, right? The problem is, as Sam McBride has shown, is that the Windsor framework comes with many of the same provisions as the protocol. It doesn't promise to do away with the sea border. There are huge issues with it. If you apply like the seven tests, I think it is, that the DUP have developed in terms of their criteria for an acceptable deal. So there are huge problems with it on if you apply that criteria. And yeah, it just doesn't remove the problem in the way the DUP and its particularly its more militant supporters would like. So what Sam McBride, I like the end of it. This is it, like Sam's a unionist, right? He's a moderate, like liberal unionist. But this is how he ends the article. He says, and I'll quote it. He says, "If Donaldson does return, it can now only be credibly in a tail between the legs fashion, which admits the sea border hasn't gone and may never go, but that the threat to the union is greater by staying out of Stormont. But whatever he does, ahead of him lies a lot of political pain." Right? So I think that's
That's the
something
conquer. Yeah,
I think
yeah.
that's sort of the position that a lot of liberal unionists have arrived at. And maybe even people within the DUP support base, like, is like, this sea border in terms of customs provisions, it all is going nowhere, not in the immediate term. There may be some deal done with the European Union further down the line by a British Labour government, but it's not going anywhere in the short to medium term. And the only thing for the DUP can do is go back into the executive. But he can't win, and that's what McBride is essentially
Yeah.
saying, you know.
People have to be getting more fed up because the frustration has to be coming towards when does the frustration outgrow people's priority of the of unionism? You know, when does that day more important than absolutely nothing happening at a local level? You know, services not receiving their funding. Like the, you know, the longer that it's shut down, people have to become more and more frustrated with seeing no action. And I think you will become closer to it being the hardline unionists who still support them in this as well.
Yeah.
The article I actually read was, again, it was in the Belfast Telegraph as well, but it was literally just about him saying he doesn't see United Ireland in his lifetime. He said, you know, I think his exact word, I think the people of Northern Ireland will continue to vote to remain part of the sixth largest economy in the world and to be part of a nation that has influence right across the globe. But what really interests me is he's talking about how abandoned that they feel by Westminster and how he doesn't see them making the argument for the union. And it's like this realization that they don't care about them, you know, that they have such strong commitment up, you know, the unionists up north have such a strong commitment to the union and that they, you know, it's so material to everyday lives. It results in such conflict. And yeah, Westminster aren't willing to, you know, to raise a kind of baby finger for them. And I just think that realization must be painful. And how they're only realizing it now is quite.
Yeah, we've gone through this cycle over and over again, where unionists place their faith in Westminster and then are abandoned or disappointed. And I think the whole Brexit shambles has been a real strong demonstration of that. It's another clear case study. The DUP, they thought they were part of something bigger. They thought they were a part of this big restatement of the British Empire, restatement of British greatness. And they were an equal partner with the Conservative Party in this project. And it's only begrudgingly and very gradually that they've come to realize that they're not. They're just a pawn in a bigger game at Westminster, as unionists have been in decades gone by, and that the British political establishment does not give one shit about this place. They would happily get rid of us in the morning if they could, and we're just a burden and an inconvenience, and the DUP is a particular inconvenience for them. So it's only gradually and begrudgingly that they're coming to that realization, but they're still trying to hang on to some sort of hope that there'll be a change in attitude on behalf of the British establishment, and certainly not this batch of Tories are going to change course. And they've said it over and over again, this is all you're getting, this is the best thing that you're getting, we're not going through this anymore.
And also, I think it's just so interesting, is that actually Brexit is what has pushed us even quicker to this conversation. Brexit has highlighted, you know, the uniqueness of Northern Ireland within, you know, the British government and the how, you know, you can't not cross the Irish Sea. Like it's, you know, like you can't get goods from Britain to Northern Ireland without having to multiply cross these imaginary borders. And I think, you know, Brexit has actually pushed us to having the conversation about United Ireland much quicker than we might have got there politically if it hadn't have been for that, because it's caused this issue, this conversation then had to happen. And the conversation about like the idea of a hard border, which was just absolutely never going to be allowed on this island again. So I think that they were part of actually bringing us to this point a hell of a lot quicker than we probably would have got there.
Yeah, they've done more in the space of, arguably done more in the space of the last 5 years to bring forward a United Ireland than the Provost managed in 30 years. They've been great champions of Irish reunification through their actions. And it's just their stupidity
Yeah.
and naivety that has made them fail to realize, or see the implications of their decisions along the way.
Thanks, Jeffrey. I think so. We are going to have a little special out later today about Lough Neagh. But I do you know anything about the protest that happened up there yesterday? There was a big protest for Lough Neagh yesterday, wasn't there, Sean?
Yeah, there was a big protest held by, it was Save Loch Nee campaign, which involves Friends of the Earth and a few other groups and campaigners. It was held just before the protest for Gaza at City Hall. The Loch Nee story has been building over the past year, mainly in response to the toxic algae that's been covering large parts of the loch. And I'm sure you hear this in the special, but
Yeah.
the segment. But people have been warned about serious problems over a much longer period due to the impact of dredging and pollution coming from agricultural runoff and sewage treatment and septic tanks. But the problems have been caused by systemic failures, including non-existent regulation by public agencies, the absence of a proper management plan, and of course the fact of the loch being in the possession of some hereditary English peer, for fuck's
So,
sake.
right, this is actually because we don't cover too much in the special, this is actually what I really wanted to ask you about. I was just blown away, and I just think the irony in it, that the fact that this, so the land is owned by this British peer, but the water isn't. And that's actually part of a lot of this conflict, like this bizarre ownership structure. So he can say he doesn't have anything got to do with, he doesn't actually own the water, but he just owns the land around it that the water is actually in, but it's this idea that at the root of this problem actually is the fact of the ownership of this land, and it's still coming, it just blew me away when I heard it. We touched on it, yeah.
Number one, the pollution is coming from
Yeah.
the lands surrounding the loch. And number two, the dredging is being done on the land below the loch. In both cases, he's just exploiting what is a critical public asset for private profit, right? And he's saying, oh, well, I'll be open to a sale, I'll be open to selling the loch. To back to the Northern Ireland executive and this kind of thing, well, we'll give him what his ancestors paid for
Yeah, exactly.
it.
Like that's I this is just it's colonialism 101. Like it's just outrageous. And the fact that it's impacting the wildlife and it's impacting the like and that this water is actually used. Now it's obviously treated, but the idea that this water is actual drinking water. This is like drinking water is taken from the loch. It obviously goes through a treatment system. But I mean it's just mind blowing to think that even on a even if the water is okay after it's treated, the idea that it's coming from this place. It's just outrageous. But yeah, so everybody, we do have a little 15-minute special on it. Have a listen, it'll be up on our page this evening. And we go into, we go into real detail on it. But listen, I think we're gonna wrap up one last kind of call to people, and it is if you can log on to the IPSC website. So it's the Irish Palestinian Solidarity Campaign. They're organizing protests right across the country. They also have, so you can look at the organizing that they're doing. You can buy flags, you can buy kaffiyas, you can financially support. And there's organizations like the Red Crescents, if you're looking to financially support anybody that's on the ground over there. There's so many different organizations trying to do what they can and trying to get aid in. It's obviously very difficult at the moment, but more importantly as well, just stay active, stay vocal. Share from as many people from within Palestine as you can, because as they lose power and as they lose access to generators and things like that, those stories aren't going to get out as much. Sean, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, just very quickly, another action maybe if you're a Unite member, sign the open letter to the Unite leadership calling for the leadership to take a stronger stance on Gaza in line with the union's policies. And if you're involved with your branch, encourage your branch to pass motions to that effect as well.
Anything you're a part of, if you're a part of a political party, if you're a part of a union, if you're a part of a residents association, if you're part of a group of people that can put some kind of letter together that has any influence, has any lobbying power, that use those structures that you're a part of, because they do have an impact. It does have an impact. We're seeing the impact that it's having. And then in terms of the media, just be so careful in terms of the media you consume. Where go to those trusted sources, try to go directly on Instagram. There are so many people on Instagram from Palestine that are literally just sharing what's happening on a daily basis. You can see it, with your own eyes. And I think that is the best place to look at it. In terms of one very last thing before we go, I had a quick look on the Irish Independent earlier on, and they have their top five stories. And the third most read story on the website is a story about a Romanian man who's been arrested for stealing tablets. You know, a load of tablets in one shop, a load of tablets in another shop. And I was like, why on earth is this the most read story, one of the most read stories on the Independent? And the headline said, man who's been in the country for 10 days is prosecuted for stealing. The papers are using our inherent kind of Islamophobia, xenophobia, racism, white supremacy, all of that. They're using how we've been conditioned to drive this clickbait. And sometimes it's just as, you know, it's bringing attention to a core story that never would have made it into the papers in the first place. But in the situation like what's happening in Gaza, it is contributing to genocide. It's contributing to people supporting their governments back in Israel. So yeah, just be careful of the content you consume. Obviously, Left Block is always a trusted source. We have loads of different podcasts. We have Trademark Belfast. We have the ABCs of Green Pod. We've so many podcasts now. Find them all on leftblock.ie. If you'd like to support us, you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/leftblock. And again, that's Left Block with a C. I've been Claire O'Connor. Thanks to Sean Boyers for joining me today. And yeah, see you next week.